Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I want to remind everyone that we Zoom the show on Monday afternoon. It will then be heard on Tuesday, so something should happen Monday night. We will not be covering it. We begin every show, as we have done now for months, with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. You are not bored with this, trust me. You need to hear his voice. It needs to be ringing in your ears when you exercise the franchise in November of 2020. If you want to know what a patriot sounds like, you hear it every day on this radio show. It is the voice of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, now Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear, for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So before I introduce my first guest, I have had the TV on in the background all day. And it has been all John Lewis all day. They marched his casket up to the rotunda. I watched him and his casket drive down the streets of Washington. I watched it come off the plane. I heard the music. It was remarkable. And I've been crying all day. And I suddenly realized that I'm crying for John Lewis. I'm crying for my country. But it's also giving me a chance to grieve for the thousands and thousands of people who have died from COVID. We have not been given permission to grieve. We have a president that is bored with the pandemic. We have governors that are trying to figure out how to respond. We have some governors that are on short leashes and will do whatever Donald Trump says. We have teachers that are writing their obituaries and their wills because they're afraid to go to school. I just heard that Google just today, Monday, announced that they are not going to bring their workers back until 2021. What does that say about safety? And I suddenly realized that John's passing was emotional because of what he stood for and the fact that he understood the urgency of the moment and the persistence. But I was grieving for so many things, including COVID-19 victims. So I just want to let you know that I wanted to sort of mention that. And then the other thing is the idea of persistence. I described him yesterday as our Moses, okay? And I want to remind everyone, Moses never got to the promised land. And my good friend did a sermon on Sunday and she shared a story I used to tell all the time when I was running for governor. And the story I would tell is very short. And it's the story of the old French general. And the old French general retires and he buys this huge, huge farm. And he calls in his gardener and he says to his gardener, "I want to plant olive trees." And the gardener looks at the old general. He says, "General, you want to plant olive trees?" He says, "Absolutely." He said, "But general, you will not get olives for 100 years. And the general chuckles and says, "Then plant them quickly." That's John Lewis. And with that, we now go to our first guest. Please, I apologize. I don't usually go on for so long. I've been following, like all of us, what's been going on in Portland. Maybe in part because my daughter was thinking of moving to Portland. She now lives in Shanghai, and because of a significant Asian population, it's closer to China than it is where I live in New Hampshire. I've been aware of this, but I've been trying to figure out what's going on. What is Donald Trump doing? What is the history of Portland? Why is there so much unrest? And why did he start there? So I decided to Google Portland protest. And I went to the University of Oregon and the same name kept cropping up. And he is now joining us. Professor Lowndes is a professor of political science at the University of Oregon. His research is on race, populism, conservatism, and social movements in U.S. politics. You now understand why he is the go-to guy. So not only does he teach this to his student, but he has a front row seat to history being made. So I want to welcome Joe to the program and thank him so much for spending some time with us. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So we'll start with Trump and what we're seeing and the feds that are being sent in. We'll do the present. But I don't want to spend a lot of time on the present, because I think if we look at the past that you had talked about with a number of the articles that I read at USA Today, it's important to see that because it really does inform the moment, because the moment isn't just about Donald Trump. And I think we need to be aware of that. It's too easy to sort of say Trump, but it doesn't actually really help or answer the questions. So let's start with what's happening right now, because we know that there are four lawsuits going on at the moment that are basically challenging what Donald Trump is doing. So talk to me about what you see happening. You used two words that I thought was interesting. One was the word dominance, and the other one was performative gain. And so I want you to sort of take those words and then explain how they inform your response to Trump.
Well, you know, the word dominance is Trump's term, not mine. It's the one that he used to in a conference call with governors and mayors around the country, told them that if they did not dominate their cities and quell the protests, the Black Lives Matter protests, he was going to send in federal agents to do that work. And that's a warning he made, you know, about a month and a half ago. Mm-hmm. And he reiterated this in his now kind of famous moment where he stood in front of the White House declaiming the violence in American streets, and then had federal agents beat protesters, in Lafayette Park before walking across to the Episcopal Church to hold up the Bible for a photo opportunity. So part of it is that, you know, what he wants to do, he has said publicly that he wants to dominate these cities, but he continually refers to them as democratic cities and democratic mayors and democratic governors who can't do this work. So by underscoring that in an election year, what he really wants to say is, this is, I as your Republican president can do what the Democrats can't do. I can curtail these protests. I can rein in these Black Lives Matter protesters. I can do it as your Republican president. And so this, you know, it's a form of campaign electioneering, a very dangerous form of campaign electioneering. So those performative gain, I would say it's meant as a form of political theater, but a form of political theater with extraordinary consequences on people's lives and health and on the stability of cities.
Well, you know, I mean, I think the thing that's still so shocking to us is, so here we are about the defund the police movement. And we just had some people who are organized with a group called POGO that kind of looks at sort of government accountability. And they looked at the militarization of the police and talking about, really since almost 1990, they've been sort of dumping extra military equipment on police forces all over the country. And sure. And most communities don't even know what their police force has. Do you know why? Because they're given it. It's kind of gifted by the federal government. And if there isn't a line item attached and you don't have to raise a dime to get your half track or your Uzi, you don't have to even mention it to the city council. It's a gift, you know? And so we've been talking about the demilitarization of the police and defunding the police. And then you see what happens in Portland. And it is the military or the paramilitary or people in fatigues or camouflage and unidentified and coming in a way that is so militaristic. It just almost reinforces what we saw happening in Minneapolis. But now it's not the homegrown cops that we're worried about. It's Donald Trump's dominance, his political theater, where obviously the homegrown can't fix it. So I am going to fix it. But fixing it's not what's happening. All he's doing is exacerbating really the hostility and the emotion of the moment. He is not quelling anything. He is literally throwing matches on something.
Sure. I mean, as he has said, these protesters want to defund the police. I will add money to these police forces, and I will send in my own federal agents to support those police. And it's actually an important distinction the military seems to be in a very different position, the actual military, in relation to this. Secretary of Defense Esper has complained that these federal agents are dressing in military gear, and he wants to make sure that to distinguish the U.S. military from these federal agents, who are Department of Homeland Security, Border Patrol, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, U.S. Marshals. And they're more directly under the control, executive control of Trump, and he has used them in this way. And so there's actually kind of an interesting split there. Stars and Stripes newspaper, the newspaper of the American military, had a headline and cover photo the other day showing federal agents attacking protesters in Portland with the headline "Frightening." So there's actually an interesting distinction going on here in what's happening.
Well, just to let you know, we're going to be interviewing someone from the Immigration Hub about immigration policy, and she wanted to make sure that we had a connection between what's been happening at the border, the abuse that you've seen happening against documented and undocumented immigrants. And you look at ICE and you look at the Border Patrol, and they are not known for respecting people's rights. They're not known for asking questions. They are known for being abusive, for hitting first and asking later. And it is just so interesting, because one of the articles I read at the Intercept said, you know, the sad thing about Portland is that we have been complaining about the Border Patrol. We've been complaining about ICE. We've been talking about the sort of toxic environment they've created at the border and what they do when they go into cities. And now in Portland, white people see it too, because it's happening to them. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was what was so interesting, was the refrain is, now that it's happening to white people, they get it too. But we've been talking about this for years.
Yes, you know, and that's always, that's, you know, the observers of fascism in the 1930s, 1920s and 30s, from colonized countries, M.A. Césaire in Africa, W.B. Du Bois in the United States, and other observers pointed out that fascism has always worked out on people of color, on brown people, on black people, on colonized people first. You hone in those practices of cruelty there, and then extend them to other populations. And that's the logic of fascism. But it was colonialism turned back on Europe in the 1930s. And we see something similar here, that this is, it's Border Patrol using Border Patrol tactics. Exactly. That's, it's also, it's worth noting here that anti-ICE militancy has been very strong in Portland for the last few years. There was an Occupy ICE around the clock demonstration at the ICE facility in Portland, which was there for a long time. Which created a lot of animosity between local activists, many of them anti-fascists, many of them anarchists, socialists, liberals, others, and ICE. And so there may be also an element here in the Trump administration of a sense of retaliation there too. You know, it's the political coalitions in play in Portland. It is white people, but it's black people, it's brown people who have been working together in coalitions against the Trump administration and against the Portland police for quite some time.
So would you consider Portland a quote-unquote sanctuary city? Is that kind of how have you defined yourself that way? Has it been framed that way? Because in a lot of ways, this is kind of, again, the excuse. Not only is it Democrats, not only do they not have to deal with these terrorists, the Antifa. I mean, it's unbelievable. But then, of course, when you see the backstory of sanctuary cities, they've been waiting for this opportunity.
Yes. And Portland is a sanctuary city. Actually, Oregon is a sanctuary state. Yeah. There's a city councilwoman named Joanne Hardesty in Portland who has made that claim against the mayor's office by saying, we are a sanctuary city and we can't allow these federal agents to be operating here. And the mayor's response was, well, this isn't, you know, we're not talking about actions against the undocumented. And she says, if it's Border Patrol snatching people off the streets, that comes under our definition of what a sanctuary city is. And what a sanctuary city means is that local police aren't allowed to work with federal agents around Border Patrol, around abducting people. And so it's not really much of an expansion of the notion of sanctuary cities to say that indeed Portland should not be allowing that.
So let me just say something, because as you were talking, I thought, so these ICE officials or these Border Patrols are picking people up. They don't know whether you're documented or not. Mm-hmm. Let's just remember this. Just because you're white, you're assuming that they oh, they must know I live here. They must know I'm a citizen. No, they are not asking questions. They are scooping you up. You don't know who they are, and they don't know who you are. So frankly, it is absolutely part of the definition of sanctuary city, because what they're doing is the same, whether it's an undocumented or a documented. What they're doing is they're misbehaving, and they're trying to somehow create a relationship with the police. And how are the police responding in Portland? Is there an affinity for the feds that are coming in, or are they also hostile to the feds coming in?
I doubt there's any hostility. I mean, one thing, in a very basic way, you know, this gives the Portland police a break, you know, from taking on the protests. It also takes a little bit of the heat and focus off of them and puts it on federal agents. But there's been longstanding grievances with the Portland police by the people of Portland, particularly Black people in Portland. Anti-fascist activists have also been long targeted in brutal ways by the police force there. So the Portland Police Bureau probably there's all kinds of reports that they are working closely with federal agents. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I have seen, you know, at protests, even 3 years ago in Portland, I was at an alt-right rally there, and there were Portland police working with Department of Homeland Security and militia, Oath Keeper militia folks, to target anti-fascist protesters. So I think the DHS works very closely with Portland police, and I'm sure the Portland Police Bureau has everything to gain by that. Now, remember, it's the police there. It's our focus should be, in some ways, the Democratic representatives of Portland, the mayor, the city council's office. They're the ones who say they don't want, and the governor's office, that they don't want the feds there. And that's the issue of sovereignty and federalism, which matters here in a political and legal way.
And as we're going to this conversation, there are four lawsuits that are happening simultaneously on a number of different levels, from the attorney general's office to the mayor. So a lot of people, there's a significant amount of pushback with sort of different raison d'être, but the same goal, I think, which is sort of interesting. We're talking with Professor Joe Lowndes. He's a professor of political science at the University of Oregon. His research is on race, populism, conservatism, and social movements in U.S. politics. How perfect. So I want to go to the history lesson, because I was blown away. So I picked up my USA Today, and here was the title: A Very Dark History, Oregon's Racist Past Fuels Protest Against Injustice in Portland. And I am thinking, that was way out in the West. We're not talking about the South. We're not talking about slaveholders or plantations. So tell my audience this history of Portland and Oregon that I was totally unfamiliar with. And it sounds like there are still significant remnants of this that are really sort of affecting the response that you're seeing now.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, that, you know, Oregon's racial history is both settler colonial. It meant wiping out indigenous peoples here. And it was also anti-Black racist. So in the territorial constitution, prior to its becoming a state, there were both pro-Confederate and pro-Union sympathies in the state legislature, or the territorial legislature. The one thing they could agree on is white supremacy. So the territorial constitution forbade both slaves and free Blacks in the state. And there's many more details to this, but that essentially Oregon was set up as a white polity, as a white state to begin with. And that carried through, you know, and across the state of Oregon, through housing covenants, through employment discrimination, through zoning, through everything else, it was a Jim Crow state where it was impossible, very difficult for Black people to live or to work, up until quite recently. The first house our family we bought here in the early 2000s. Still had a covenant on the deed that forbade the house to be sold to Black people, which has all these old housing covenants have that on there. Right. So that's a key part of this. And so Portland in particular, Portland's Black population is about 6% of the city's population. There are the Black neighborhoods suffer gentrification, police abuse, and kind of like general, more broadly, kind of like racial animosity. You know, you talk to most Black folks who live anywhere in Oregon, you'll hear that story over and over. The Ku Klux Klan had a very strong presence here in the 1920s and 1930s. They were Klan mayors, they were important, they were Klan presidents of the University of Oregon, for instance. So we have buildings that until recently were named after Klan leaders. So that was something that was, you know, quite, you know, it was a big part of what Oregon was.
So Oregon seems, you know, so that was a little bit shocking that whether you were free or slave, you were not allowed into Oregon is, I mean, talk about putting up the moat around the state. So it really was set up as a white enclave, you know, and knowing that, and now seeing what's happening here, and there's a real concern with the African-American community about the history of how they're being treated. How is Oregon and Portland in specific, how are they dealing with their past? So obviously everyone's responding to what happened in Minneapolis. And so there's been this whole ripple of reaction. But there appears from what you said that there has been a bit of a history of this. So it wasn't just Minneapolis that sort of inspired this. But Oregon seems to be a hotbed of, how do I say this? Just a hotbed of, they like to organize and not necessarily riot, but it just feels like a place where protest is part of how I imagine Portland, that they sort of celebrate the idea of protest. So yes. I am looking at what's happening with how many days it's been going on and what's going on now with the feds coming in. And I said this to an activist who's going to be joining us tomorrow, who's actually covering it on the street. He's kind of a journalist. And I said, and I'm going to ask you the same thing. What's the goal? What's the goal? I mean, I know you want the feds gone, but once the feds are gone, what's the goal? Because that's the one thing I keep thinking about. And I know that one of the things that's been happening is the graffiti on the federal courthouse. And yet it turns out that the judges may be your best friend. And Timothy Snyder, who wrote a book called On Tyranny, says one of the 20 lessons he says is protect institutions. And one of the institutions I would think these people want to protect are the courts. So I'm just trying to figure out if there's any kind of conversation about how you define the goal and what is that goal?
Well, you know, I mean, the discussion of the courts as a, you know, certainly the courts are complicated in a democracy, particularly in the United States. The Supreme Court has been a mostly reactionary institution, except for a period in the mid-20th century. It has been, you know, it's undemocratic or anti-democratic. So I think the question of the courts and democracy actually is a complicated one. But that aside, the question about what happens if the feds leave, there's still a lot of unfinished business with the Portland police. 25% of the police killings that have happened in the last decade have been Black people. Again, it's only 6% of the population. So there's a really, really deep problem of racial killing and racial profiling and racial abuse by the Portland Police Department. And there's also a problem of, from the activist perspective, of the police as an institution which is impenetrable, which is difficult to govern or have authority over, that it's venal, corrupt, bullying. And so there's many, many problems that have been sticking in the craw of the progressive community in Portland for quite some time. What the Black Lives Matter movement has called for is to defund the police by half, and take that money and put that into programs in communities of color. It's actually a less radical set of demands than you saw in Minneapolis, which is entirely dismantling the police, or many other places. So there are a clear set of goals here that Black Lives Matter activists have asked for. Police accountability and defunding police are at the heart of that.
So you said that how is the mayor receptive to that request? Was it blown off and sort of rolled their eyes and they sort of walked away and said, you know, no, we're not even talking about this? What was the reaction of the police chief? I know that you've been going through quite a few police chiefs. I think your most recent one, who happens to be an African American, has only been on the job for 6 months. Not an easy job for anyone, I suspect. But I'm just sort of, what is the reaction? Is the reaction no? Or is the reaction, let's have a conversation? And in part, I want to know how the mayor has reacted, because that also sort of makes me understand what's happening in the streets.
Well, you know, the mayor, Ted Wheeler, is a, you know, he ran as a centrist. He's partly a representative of the business community. And there's a sense that he's not seen as a progressive ally, probably would not necessarily see himself that way. And so I think among many progressives in the city, and certainly the activist community, they don't see him as somebody who is on their side. I think his position with the police is that he feels kind of stuck in terms of where who his loyalties are with and what that means. I think that he is in a particularly vulnerable position right now, and probably is not seen as standing up for the interests he was elected to stand up for, and probably not liked by other forces as well. So I think that there are tensions between the mayor's office and people on city council, mayor's office and progressive institutions in the city, and the mayor's office and the ever-growing coalition of people who were on the streets, who I was there on Saturday night, and it was, you know, it was thousands and thousands of people out there. So, he has said he wants the feds out too, which is actually a position which is a stronger position than, say, Mayor Lightfoot in Chicago has had. But I think he's in a little bit of a tight spot, I think.
So before I let you go, so as I'm hearing this, you just heard Ken Barnes mention this to you before you came on the air with us, that the idea was that it's now becoming sort of a white event, not a Black Lives Matter event. And I'm just going to say something, because you mentioned the percentage of African Americans in Portland and Oregon is a very small percentage. And if they were the only ones out on the street, there would not be significant numbers. Mm-hmm. In order for those numbers to happen, you need allies. Mm-hmm. So the question is, because someone is white, are they taking over an event? Or because someone is white, are they perceived as an ally? Because we're beginning to see all this pushback. I saw it in the media, and there's a bunch of articles saying it's now a white event. And I'm just trying to figure out, how do we work together, Joe?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You have to actually distinguish between who's speaking on whose behalf. The article that was the op-ed piece in the Washington Post,
yes,
by an NAACP official who has, you know, who's in a different place than Black Lives Matter activists.
Okay.
What you see in the streets is a lot of, it's multiracial on the streets of Portland, and many young Black and brown activists and leadership there on the streets. Inviting white allies to be there with them against both the feds and the Portland police. And so, and you see really centered there continually, Black Lives Matter, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, the police murders that have happened in Portland. And you see a real earnestness around this issue. And so this idea of it being a white spectacle is partly a media creation. Partly it's what happens when you bring Donald Trump and his federal agents in. Many more Portlanders who might not have decided to throw themselves into the struggle,
exactly,
now are much more willing to do
so. Right.
So
Donald Trump is an invitation where, whether it was initially was a Black Lives Matter event or whatever, but now they're seeing Trump and the feds, and a lot of Oregon is obviously very opposed to Donald Trump. So it's now an additional invitation that rather than sitting home, you need to be out there and join them.
That's exactly right.
Joe Lowndes, thank you so much for doing this. We may have to call you again. I'm hoping that maybe in a couple of weeks we're going to be able to tap this down, but that's not what Donald Trump wants.
Yeah.
He doesn't want it to end because it's a distraction from COVID. He doesn't want it to end. It's a distraction from the economy. He doesn't want it to end. It's a distraction from his, you know, plummeting numbers when it comes to his, you know, his election in 2020. And in a lot of ways, not only does this sort of relate to the base, but he thinks it's his strategy for suburban housewives. I don't know. Are there still suburban housewives?
Like a 1950s kind of.
Yeah. Well, he's so stuck in 19. I mean, I think he still watches Leave It to Beaver, you know? As I'm listening to him, I feel like that's what I'm hearing from him. But so in a way, I feel for Portland because it is theater. And right now that's all he has. He doesn't have content. He doesn't have solutions. He doesn't have policy. But because he can take these Homeland Security people and these border patrols and use them effectively and grab the attention of the media, as you just pointed out, then it's working for him. It just isn't working for the rest of us.
Can I ask you, Joe, if there's any factual basis, or what are the facts about Trump's allegation that so many of the people on the streets, he refers to them as the Antifa people, the people that are wanting to break windows anyway, if not burn down the city. And most of people like me and Arnie, you know, white progressives around the country, have seen all of these protests, including in Portland, as being mostly people of color and white people
peaceful,
who are really supportive of the Black Lives Matter movement, the Stop Police Violence, Stop the Militarization of Police. And are there any numbers that are going to justify Trump's allegations, or does that vary with if it's after 10 o'clock at night or whatever?
Yeah, I think that, you know, partly that there are different kinds of people out in the streets. And, you know, particularly in the hours between, say, 1 a.m. and 4 a.m., there are people who are more ready to fight it out with federal agents who are there. I would say, though, that, you know, if you're there in the protest, the feeling you get the most of is this extraordinary coalition of teachers, labor activists, doctors, lawyers, and, you know, young people, and extraordinarily supportive across everyone. The feelings are of great mutuality and mutual care. And you don't get a sense of it being chaotic or violent until the feds come out, and then it gets quite serious. And there, people are quite supportive of each other. And there's a certain kind of maturity and seriousness there that you see, which is really, I find quite heartening, I would say.
Well, you've made me very happy too. So I'm so glad to hear that sober conversation. Anyway, Joe Lowndes, thank you so much for joining us. Stay healthy, stay well, and we'll be back in touch, I have a feeling.
You too, Arnie. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneston and producer Ken Barnes. We'll be right back.
Immigration scene, shining and feeling clean. Could it be a sin? I got stopped by the immigration man. He said he doesn't know if he can. Let me in, let me in. Immigration man, can I cross the line and pray I can stay another day? Man, I won't tow your line today. I can't see it anyway.
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneston and producer Ken Barnes. Again, I want to remind everyone, we Zoom this show on Monday afternoon. So we've been talking with Tyler Moran for, God, almost years now. It's just so exciting. She is the director of the Immigration Hub. She previously worked as a senior policy advisor to ex-Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid of Nevada, as a deputy policy director for immigration at the White House Domestic Policy Council under President Barack Obama. Whenever I have a question about immigration, the undocumented, I see something happening, I get nervous and I go, oh my God, we need to sort of get caught up. So Tyler Moran, welcome back to the program. There is so much on our plate, but I picked the right day to call you because you just released some polling information that is very, very important. And I want to remind everyone that, you know, we're looking at 2020. We know Joe Biden appears to be beating Donald Trump in places that historically no Democrat has ever won. He's beating him for a lot of reasons, in part because Donald Trump is Donald Trump. But the immigration question has always made people a little uncomfortable. Is this a good thing to talk about? Is this a bad thing to talk about? Can we be risk averse and not discuss it? So you decided, you know what? What the hell? Let me go in and ask the question about immigration. And you found some fascinating results. So why don't you describe for our audience what the questions were, what the goal was, and more importantly, what the results were, which were, I think, somewhat shocking to those of us that were reading it.
100%. I think even shocking to us. So I think after 2016, there was this narrative that, you know, Trump won because of xenophobia, his immigration policies. And I think there also was this conventional wisdom that when immigration is discussed, Trump is always going to win and Democrats should avoid the issue. So we started doing research soon thereafter the election, digital testing and polling to figure out how do you talk to these moderate voters that flipped from Obama to Trump or who stayed home in the 2016 election. It had some great results on polling, finding that voters really respond to values-based messages, that they don't support separating children from their families, ending DACA. And so this last project was we wanted to find a voter model. So we asked the question, are there actual voters who will change their vote choice based on immigration content? And that's what we found, which is millions of actual people, moderate voters in the Rust Belt, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and then Colorado, who move away from Trump when exposed to immigration content and toward Democrats. We did this before Biden was the nominee. What's most surprising is that the voters in the model skew male, non-college educated, white and suburban. And so I just want to say, we did a bunch of testing and work in the midterms in 18, and we're really focused on proof points. And so we did some A/B digital testing, and we found—
Now, what is a proof point? Tell me, I mean—
it's research.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, I just don't, like, I can talk about stuff as much as I want, but I want it backed up with research so we can demonstrate to campaigns and candidates and the political class that what we're saying actually is backed up by something. And so in 18, when we had Lou Barletta running against Casey in Pennsylvania, in Trump's image, caravan ads, we did a bunch of testing and found that suburban women were turned off by it, and it drove them toward the Democratic candidate. And so it was really fascinating to find this model where you're finding men, non-college educated. And I want to say that the model, it skews people who are moderate. You take out the partisans. So you take out the definite Biden people and the definite Trump people, and you're finding people in the middle. And so the lesson, I think, for us is, okay, Democrats, Donald Trump is running on immigration. You know, there's no choosing if it's going to be part of the election campaign. He's going to do it. He thinks it was successful in 16. He's already spent, I think, $3.5 million last year just on Facebook on ads alone. So it's going to be an issue. So since it's an issue for Trump and down ballot candidates, Democrats need to articulate what they're for. They're for solutions. They're for fairness. They're for humanity.
So tell me what it was at these white men, white male moderates, what was the trigger for them? Is it that they know? I mean, so the reason I say this is, so I'm walking down the street and there are a bunch of roofers, and the roofers are working, and but basically they're speaking Spanish. So you know that no matter what you do, you are probably in connection with someone who is an undocumented immigrant or someone who's from another country. And then you find out that you value their work product. And then you find out that you actually need people to help you at this point in time. And now with COVID-19, the situation is getting even more dicey. I'm just trying to figure out what was the questions that were asked and how was it framed and what did they mirror back to you? What did they say to you? Yeah. Because this to me is a celebration. If you can find them, I would marry them. I just want to know. But I want to know what it is that was the connection.
Yeah, so I think fairness, patriotism, and interdependency. So we showed them videos. We showed there was a control group, then there was a Trump ad, a really, pretty bad xenophobic ad from him. And then we showed a video. One was of a military veteran talking about how Trump's policies don't represent American values and how his border policies make us less safe. And then we showed a second video about a home healthcare worker who was an immigrant and the elderly woman she took care of. And so it was really about their relationship and the interdependency. So these are like core American values. And I think it just really spoke to people.
You know, it's so funny as you're talking about the immigrant taking care of someone. So, and it's interesting because there was a woman from Haiti who took care of my dad, and I swear my father fell in love with her. And I think she fell in love with him. And that got my brother so disgusted, and I was so celebratory because I just said, my God, look what he has. And it's not even just the care. It's about human relationship. You know, it wasn't that she was from Haiti. It wasn't her color. It was their humanity that sort of connected them together. I would have loved to have made that into a commercial and said, tell me this person isn't important. This person, I wish this person was my mother, you know? And that's really what you kind of saw in that relationship. And it sounds like when you sort of say that to people and you show that to people, they get it. They get it. You know, you can't, with all the things that Donald Trump does, one of the things that we realize right now, especially because of COVID, is that you need someone to touch you. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of these individuals are in the business of touching. And that's something that we're craving and we need. And I think that is a lot of, that's kind of an immigration story that says, this is not only, it's good for us emotionally, it's good for us as a country. And this is really, this does represent our values.
Yeah, he's trying to other people. He's trying to scare voters. And when it comes down to it, they are seeing that, just as you said, people are part of the fabric of this country. and have the same values as we all do. And it's Donald Trump that doesn't have the right values.
Exactly.
You know, at this, you brought something up too, which I think has been really critical over the last few months, which is the role that immigrants are playing along with many other workers who are essential workers on the front lines combating COVID, you know, and whether it's doctors, nurses, grocery store, I mean, you've seen the data about the health disparities, yeah. Because so many people who are Black and Brown are on the front lines. But I think it's really brought to light, hopefully for folks, the ways that immigrants, both documented and undocumented, are at the front lines and really helping keep the country moving right now.
Absolutely, absolutely. And again, that's another part of the story that you said we need to tell, because it will actually move voters, and you now have the proof points to support that, Tyler Moran. So yeah. The other thing, we just talked to a professor from the University of Oregon about Portland. And one of the things we see is that everybody's offended. There are now 4 lawsuits going on because of the feds showing up. But it's not just generically the feds. It's Border Patrol. It's ICE. It's kind of, you know, Homeland Security folks. So it's not the military. And that was the one thing that Joe kept saying was, this is not the military. The military wants people to know this is not the Army. This is not the Navy. This is not the Air Force. This is kind of this sort of amorphous thing. And one of the articles I read at The Intercept was talking about the fact that, you know, because you've been working in immigration for a long time, you know how Border Patrol acts. You know how ICE acts. They don't respect people. They don't read people their rights. They tend to sort of beat first and ask later. Well, you've seen that for a long time happening, whether they're going into a city, going after someone, or whether they're doing it at the border, or whether they're doing it when they're warehousing children and separating them from their parents. What is so interesting about Portland is that now Portland is experiencing what has been a known phenomena at the border. And as someone said, well, finally, white people are experiencing it too, and they are offended by it, that they're being scooped up. No one's identifying themselves. No one's giving them the rights. And in a way, it's sad that it has to happen to white people for people to understand what you have been talking about, you've been beating the drum about. Now the question is, how do we take that connection of what the Border Patrol does in Texas and connect it to what we're seeing happening in Portland and saying, this is now your experience. Understand who's been living this experience and why it's been so wrong for so long.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's been a cultural awakening across the country just at the systemic racism and also police brutality. And certainly it's been a story that I think immigrant advocates, particularly those who live in the border themselves, have been trying to tell for quite some time. You know, I'm glad that people are horrified about what's happening of snatching people off the streets and unmarked cars, no name badges. But this has been happening for quite some time. I mean, under immigration law, the 100 miles from the border, those are constitution-free zones where people are constantly being stopped and picked up. This is the agency that took little kids from their parents. This is the agency that's responsible for multiple deaths in custody. This is the agency that had the Facebook group, remember, that was a closed Facebook group that had lots of racist and sexist comments. Now, this is not to say that everyone who is an agent, you know, there's many people that go in there to be civil servants and, you know, to serve with pride, but unfortunately, that's not what's happening right now. And Gil Kerlikowske, who is the former commissioner of Border Patrol under President Obama, he said, it's clearly the wrong group to be doing this. It's not something they're trained to do. My guess is
What are they trained to do? Because let me just say something. If what they're doing on the border has been consistent, and now they're taking that border behavior and they're putting it into Portland, it's wrong on the border too.
Yeah.
If that's what they were trained to do, that's wrong. They need to be retrained. And that was going to be my question. So in a lot of ways, you've teed it up for me. I just want to know, what is the profile of Border Patrol? What is the profile of ICE? Because one of the things we've been talking about with the police, for example, is that we find out that a lot of the abusive police have never been dealt with. And they don't just have one incident, they have 20 incidents or 40 incidents. And what happens is once that nobody sort of seems to blink and they sort of stay on the force and they don't get fired, it kind of sets a legitimacy for that kind of behavior, not just for them, but for everyone on the force. And what I tweeted out the other day was, if you want more than defund the police, we need to have accountability. And if there had been accountability 15 years ago, 20 years ago, we would not be at this place. we would be safer, the cops wouldn't be behaving the way they were, and we wouldn't be at this sort of hostile situation. Well, as we're looking at that with the defund the police, my question is to that guy who said they weren't trained for this, I want to ask him the question, what the hell were they trained for?
You're raising a really good point, and I think this is what border advocates have been pushing for quite some time, which is transparency and accountability. Like, they should have to wear body-worn cams, just like other police officers in certain cities. There should be transparency about what happens when a complaint is filed about an officer who has violated someone's civil rights. So I'm not an expert.
No, I know that.
It's like a big agency. It's one of the biggest law enforcement agencies in the country. And Donald Trump has made it about people and asylum seekers, but they have a broad, broad mission, right? There's ports of entry where you have hundreds of thousands of cars and trucks, trade and travel, food inspection every day. There are issues also of just the border and, you know, to folks like drug traffickers, human smugglers, obviously folks that you don't want to keep in the country. And then there's people who are coming here to seek a better life, to seek asylum. And those folks have become sort of the point of the story under Donald Trump and seen as a threat. But the mission is actually much, much broader. But certainly they were not trained to be kind of paratroopers on our city streets picking up U.S. citizens.
Absolutely. I mean, again, and so at some point in time, that's where, if we have a new administration, which I'm lighting candles to make sure that that happens, and I will vote. But as we're looking at this, I really do think we have to sort of rethink what it is that's in the profile of the people that we are bringing in. Because even if you're going after drug traffickers, or if you're going, you know, you're dealing with a refugee, or you're dealing with a truck coming from Canada, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, there has to be some sort of certain sort of profile that still shows a sense of humanity and respect. And I don't care who you're dealing with in that way. And I just feel like it's become a dumping ground for people who, it's kind of like, you know, the arsonist who wants to become a firefighter. And I just feel like they're collecting a lot of arsonists into this organization. And that is not good. It's not good for the country. It's not good for our security and safety. And now when you're seeing Donald Trump taking this group of people who, as you point out, you know, maybe we haven't been as appreciative of their bad behavior because it hasn't touched us. Well, now it's touching us in Chicago. It'll be touching us in Kansas. It'll be touching us in, you know, Portland, Oregon. And all of a sudden, it's like a wake-up call. So that's where I wanted to sort of continue to go, because you showed these new polling numbers and you said you can talk about this in 2020. Is there going to be an opportunity to talk about what we're talking about now and connecting it to the election of 2020? Because it's a wonderful way of saying they started with them and now they've gotten to you. So mm-hmm. if the beginning was wrong, guess what? By the time they got to you, it was wrong too. It's, you know, who do they come for first, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that this is a powerful moment to educate the population on this, because they are afraid and offended, but they don't necessarily understand the arc of history.
Can I just amend the question a little bit, Arnie? Because white folks did understand and have the values to say no 2 years ago when Trump instituted his zero tolerance policy, when he instituted the separating families policy. Last year, we were down at Homestead, the children in detention. There's been a lot of sentiment among at least part of the white population, even though they weren't coming for us. But now, tying this in, just like Black Lives Matter have been saying for decades that police are mistreating them and discriminating against them, but now people are listening. And so it seems that there's a bigger majority of the country that is joining this wave of protest, and that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I do think there's a moment, and I think that immigrant rights advocates are making that connection. I do think, you know, when the Black Lives Matter protests and awareness started, people really wanted to center Black immigrants and Black voices and you know, what work folks were doing to raise visibility about sort of the law enforcement accountability, and so to create space for that. But I do think conversations have started about the linkages across Black and Brown communities and the abuse that people are suffering from law enforcement agencies. So yes, 100%, there's a way to talk about accountability and transparency across the board within all law enforcement agencies.
Well, just to let you know, Joe Lowndes from the University of Oregon said something very interesting. He said, once the feds show up, the numbers of people on the streets increased. Because, you know, yeah, they were concerned about Black Lives Matter, and yeah, they were concerned about police abuse. But once they saw the feds on the street, they saw them rounding up people, they saw them not identifying themselves, they saw them wearing camo, they saw this, they were like, what? And that brought out even more people into the streets. So that, to me, sends that he's overstepped it. Mm-hmm. You know, this is where people who might have been worried, like Ken says, and oh yeah, they're aware of what's happening at the border and they care, but they're not, you, Ken, they're not going down to the border. They're not, you know, talking to the kids. They're not spending there, but they get it, but they're not emotionally connected the way you are. What I think Donald Trump has shown in Portland is that he's creating a new relationship, not good for him, but good for those of us who care about justice, who care about a disclosure and transparency, who care about the fact that we do want stability and security on our streets. What they are doing is the exact opposite. That's what we see happen in a fascist situation. We don't see this happening in a democracy.
That's right. I mean, and it started with Lafayette Park, right? With that like stupid show of like going over and holding the Bible. And this is a continuation of that, which they obviously think that this is a winning electoral strategy to show that he's law and order, but it's backfiring. I mean, if you look at the polling across the board, not just ours, and if you look at the responses on the streets, it's backfiring.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So Ken wanted us to absolutely sort of end this conversation with Tyler Moran, the head of the Immigration Hub, about what's happening with the children staying at the hotels. And I was told that a bunch of lawyers were trying to call the kids, but then the phones were taken out. And I mean, it's like whack-a-mole. Every time you try to figure out what to do, they somehow put a new restriction in so that anything in the way of justice isn't happening. So walk me through what is going on there and what is the status as we speak now?
Yeah, I think you had raised the issue of the kids that were being detained in hotels. I think I've talked about this in the past, that there's a policy that says that there's only a limited amount of time that you can detain a child. And so I think they're trying to get around that by putting kids in hotels. And you're right, there have been efforts of people to go in to speak with the children, lawyers that wanted to represent them who were kicked out. Most recently in family detention, the lawyers went back to court to have these kids released because they were detained longer than they should have been. The lawyer said that they needed to be released. And unfortunately, what ICE is saying now is, so what they could do is they could release the families together. And they're saying that they want to release the children and not the parents. So this is family separation 2.0 if they go forward with this. And as you both know, that was hugely destructive to hundreds and hundreds and thousands of children, not hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands of children who are separated from their parents. So it's family separation 2.0.
So you said that they were putting them in hotels and that was a way to sort of circumvent what the rule was, that you shouldn't hold them for so long. So what do they think this is, an Airbnb? I mean, do they get to rate the motel they're staying at? Do they get to sort of order food and, you know, go? I mean, I'm just trying to, how the H, whether you call it a detention center or you call it a hotel, if you are restricted, you are restricted. I don't care what the name is outside.
I think they're trying to hide the kids. They're trying to pretend that they're not holding these kids in detention and nobody knows about it. And then when the advocates, Texas Civil Rights Organization or whoever, finds out about it and outs them, then those kids count. But I think Border Patrol's goal is to hide the kids and tell Judge G that, no, those kids don't count towards our numbers of detained children.
You saw this during family separation, if you remember the stories that were revealed of like moving kids in the middle of the night up to New York to ship them up there. I mean, it's just, it's not doing under the light of day.
I remember, Arnie, when I had visited Homestead, the Child Detention Center in Florida, the first time I went, there were 3,000 kids. The second time I went, there were about 1,800 kids. And a month and a half later, ICE was, or DHS was saying, oh, gee whiz, there's no kids left. We found them all appropriate sponsorships. And who the heck knows where they really are, where they sent them? Maybe they deported them. Maybe they gave them to Betsy DeVos for adoption. Maybe, who knows what they did with them? Maybe they're in hotels somewhere.
Yeah, it's not okay.
So, Tyler, before I let you go, right now the Democratic Party is working on their platform. So I don't know whether you are engaged with that platform on immigration policy, but can you give me a tiny little window in where obviously you put this poll out because you want people to know you can talk about this? You know, this is not nuclear waste. This is something you can actually talk about. What does Joe Biden's platform look like? Is it very much similar to what we saw with Barack Obama, who sent a lot of people back home to Mexico and to Latin America? Or is it something that's a little more vibrant and realizes that we really need to have a whole new conversation about our immigration policy?
I mean, there's a draft that was, released to the press. And I think there, a big component of it is righting the wrongs. So I think Trump, there's over 700 policies that he implemented during his time. So it was really just rapid fire. The ones that you know about, like the Muslim and African ban and DACA, but to, lower level, like shackling pregnant women again, or, so they do highlight that they need to right the wrongs, and that's a really important thing, but they also need to lean in. And so another component of the release platform that we've seen is that he's recommitting to DACA, and also to figure out what to do with the parents of DACA recipients, and also to use this political capital to push Congress to finally move to legalize all the undocumented Americans in the country.
And just remind my audience, when was the last time we actually changed the numbers of people who are allowed into this country? I just want everyone to know that I think that the numbers of undocumented nannies in New York probably exceeds the number that are permitted to come into the entire United States. When was the last time we actually did anything looking at our immigration numbers and our immigration policy?
Yeah, so it was the early 1990s was the last, bill that actually made some reforms to the immigration system. We've talked about this in the past. It really is like it's interconnected, which is you not only have to have a path to citizenship for people who are living in this country without papers, but you have to reform the legal immigration system because it is so difficult to come here legally.
Exactly. You know,
it's like a 1985 computer. It's ridiculous. It's 20-year waits for people to reunite with family, an economy that's not matched up to the visas. Like, we don't really need any, more nuclear physicists. We actually need people who are going to fill nurses, teachers, and these core jobs that our country has a shortage of.
People need to know that. Get to the back of the line. The line is 20 years long. I want people to know. Nobody says this anymore. We somehow think everybody knows it, but they don't, Tyler. That's part of the conversation.
People want to come here legally. It's incredibly difficult.
Thank you. And on that note, Tyler Moran runs the Immigration Hub. We so love having her join us. You can't stay away so long because as we move into the 2020, there's going to be obviously a little more nuances to our conversation. So stay well and stay healthy.
Take care, both of you.
All right, ciao. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.